That lies, the Israeli military says it has launched artillery attack on southern Lebanon after several rockets were fired toward Israel. Israeli forces razed to the ground about 20 shops belonging to Palestinians in Al-Quds, the latest in a series of demolitions in the occupied territories. And Taliban militants claim responsibility for a deadly blast targeting Afghanistan's defense minister and one of more attacks on top Afghan officials. Our top story for this half hour, the Israeli military says it has shelled areas inside Lebanon after a number of rockets were fired toward Israel. Earlier we were joined by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Salah, who gave us more details.
Well, we know that around three rockets were fired from Lebanon, reportedly one of them fell in Lebanese territory. Two others reached a settlement of Kiryat Shmona. They resulted in some fires in that area, but as the Israeli sources have said, no real casualties as a result of the firing of the rockets. Of course, there was the Israelis also fired tank shells on the area of near the Wazani River in the plains, basically in open areas, not residential areas. We know that there was a meeting also between the Israeli prime minister and the defense minister, the war minister, to decide upon what was happening. We know from Israeli media that it seems things will go back to calm. We know that the Israeli shelling has stopped now against southern areas. Of course, this is not the first time that these issues have happened. And we're talking about several incidents in the last year. Just in April, we had also a similar incident. Basically, what we're looking at, almost even from analysis from the Israeli side, they're blaming rogue Palestinian groups. They have not blamed Hezbollah for any of those rockets. We're talking about Katyusha rockets.
Israeli forces have demolished several shops belonging to Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds. Israeli forces, accompanied by bulldozers, razed to the ground about 20 shops in Hizma, northeast of Al-Quds. This is the latest in a series of demolitions carried out by Israel against Palestinian homes and facilities in the occupied territories. Israel claims that the structures lack construction permits. This is while such documents are nearly impossible to obtain. Palestinians say the demolitions are part of Israeli efforts to expand its settlements that are illegal under international law. The UK Maritime Trade Operation says a potential hijack of a Panama-flagged vessel off the coast of the UAE has ended. The security agency said the ship is safe and boarders have left the tanker. It did not give any details in its warning notice. On Tuesday, maritime sources said the Asphalt Princess tanker had been seized off the coast of the United Arab Emirates. They also accused Iran of being behind the incident. A spokesman for the Iranian military dismissed the anti-Tehran allegations. Brigadier General Abul Fazl Shekarchi said Israel and its allies from the region and beyond are waging a media war against Iran, using psychological warfare and creating pretexts for adventurism. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mostafa Khoshchesh, journalist and political commentator, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also, we have Ryan Dawson, political analyst and broadcaster, joining us from Osaka. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Khoshchesh. Sir, give us your thoughts on events that have transpired recently. The maritime sources blame Iran. Iran has vehemently denied those anti-Tehran allegations. What are your thoughts?
It was expected from the Israelis and Americans to start hues and cries about the current affairs in the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, and go for high, false flag, hijacking and unreal stories, and in order to, you know, rally international support for their bid to win a UN Security Council resolution against Iran. They are actually disturbing security in the Persian Gulf. That's detrimental to the security of all the neighbors on the rims, northern and southern rims of the Persian Gulf, because the Israelis and Americans have long proved that they don't care for security in this region, because they don't live in this part of the world, so they don't sustain much damage, while other countries in the region are victims of such hues and cries. After the failure to rally support for a UN resolution, after the ship incident in the last few days, they went for this false flag operation in order to pressure international society into accompanying them for pressuring Tehran. It's a long time that Israelis and Americans have been developing plots in order to deter the IRGC that's in charge of the Persian Gulf, in order to widen their own presence and find a foothold in the Persian Gulf, in order to, you know, transfer the lands of tension, the hotbeds of tension, from the occupied territories where they are under, you know, a siege of resistant forces to territories adjacent to Iran. So they have now moved ahead and done the first part of their plans in order to, you know, disturb the situation, disturb security in the Persian Gulf and Gulf of Oman through psychological warfare, in order to rally, you know, to pressure or coax international community into supporting their bid. This is nothing new. They have already done that several times. We do all remember when they attacked Iraq under the pretext that WMDs have been traced in Iraq, and they found nothing. And the scandal in Iraq apparently has not been enough for the Americans, and the Israelis have now joined the Americans to repeat false flag, unreal stories about the current state of affairs in this part of the world. But what they don't care and what they don't pay attention to is that when they set fire to the stability and peace and security of the region, you will be burnt as well. You have a lot to lose. They do a lot of trade in this part of the world. But apparently they are insane enough in their quest for winning the support of other countries, that they go lunatic and they go, you know, for such false flag operations and media hype in order to damage Iran's credit. But the ultimate goal, as I said, one of the ultimate goals is, you know, deterring Iranian presence and active presence of the IRGC in the region. But as we do know IRGC and their policies, they would not be deactivated, they would not be intimidated or influenced by such plots, and they stand firm in reciprocating any kind of animosity towards Iran, as has been the case in the past, especially in the past couple of years.
Ryan Dawson, I saw you nodding there. Give us your thoughts on the issue. Mr. Khoshesh believes that the likes of the United States actually care very little for any form of security in the Persian Gulf region.
Yes, and this is propaganda. They decided it was Iran without any evidence or motive. Why would Iran hijack a ship which has little to gain? It doesn't make a dime's worth of difference trade-wise. And while they're in the middle of negotiating with the United States to reinstitute the Iran deal, they would risk it all over a vote. Now, the United States has started two wars on false pretexts where they claim their ships were attacked. Their war in Vietnam, the blame of the Gulf of Tonkin, which never happened, and of course the Spanish-American War with the Maine. And yet, when their ships are attacked, the British ship, the USS Patria, was attacked by the Israelis, and the USS Liberty was attacked by the Israelis. Britain and the United States did nothing. So when their boats are attacked, it doesn't matter. And when they're not attacked, or when they make it up, they use it to go to war. And they ceded territory from Spain. They took the Philippines, and they killed 2 million people in Vietnam. Now, this latest is a pretext to say, well, if Iran is hijacking our ships or attacking it with drones, then the U.S. or Israel will be able to seize Iranian ships, claiming that, well, that's what Iran did, even without evidence. And the story is really stinks, the fact that the ship was hijacked, and then the people who did it just left. And nobody knows who they were, and where did they go, and why weren't they followed. It doesn't make any sense. It just seems like a false flag that the media is running with, and no motive or evidence seems to be necessary, which seems to be how most war propaganda tends to go. Each lie, it just dies within one news cycle, and then they're on to the next lie, and then the next lie, which you can see clearly in recent times with Iraq, and then Libya, and then Syria, and now Iran.
Ryan Dawson, I'm going to stay with you. As you mentioned, there are a lot of holes in this plot. The question is, who really benefits from this sense of insecurity in the region?
Yes, who would want to squash the Iran deal between the United States and Iran? And who would want to seize Iranian ships? And who has recently been saying they'll go at it with Iran alone? Prime Minister Bennett of Israel. The entire U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is directed by Zionist influencers. It doesn't benefit the United States to be occupying Rojava or helping terrorists in Syria. It didn't benefit the United States to invade Iraq twice. And now the oil from Iraq is being sent to China. It doesn't benefit the U.S. to have sanctions on Iran. But they do, because there's a very strong Zionist lobby, which affects the presidency and the Congress. They're very powerful, and the press favors conflict, no matter what it is. They do the same thing for Salafist jihadists from Saudi Arabia. When you have religious extremists, be they Muslim or Jewish, or anybody that's extremist, they get a nice fat paycheck from the CIA. They get logistical support. They've been given weapons. And they're caught doing this over and over again, from Iran-Contra to now. The U.S. has covertly supported militant groups to destabilize different countries. And it doesn't seem to matter how many times they're caught doing the same old song and dance. The media doesn't report it, which means both parties are involved. And this most recent hijacking in north of Oman is a ridiculous narrative. How can people hijack a ship and then just leave without being caught? It doesn't make any sense at all. And why would you blame Iran? What is the evidence? You just think it's Iran because you need it to be, because you want to seize their ships? There's no motive for Iran to do that. It would be insane for Iran to start hijacking ships out of the blue, while they're in the middle of negotiating one of the biggest economic deals in for their future since the deal was made. And they just came off positive talks last June. So why would they sabotage us? Who would want to sabotage us? Obviously, the Israelis.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen, journalist and political commentator Mustafa Khoshchesh, joining us from Tehran. And also thanks to political analyst and broadcaster Ryan Dawson, speaking to us from Osaka. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. The Commander-in-Chief of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is a complete failure for Washington 20 years after its occupation of the country.
This is a complete failure for the Americans, who are returning to the point where they started from 20 years ago. The Americans have only brought insecurity to Afghanistan and created a dangerous situation, like a civil war there. Washington's strategy is to establish a country without any government there, and in that situation, only the oppressed Afghan civilians are the ones who bear the brunt of the wrong U.S. policies.
Salami said U.S. presence in West Asia violates national sovereignty and integrity in the regional countries. He said the United States failed to change the security situation in the political spectrum in Afghanistan, and that's a reflection of pursuing wrong approaches for 20 years. The IRGC commander said the Americans have never sought progress in any country, and they brought destruction wherever they stepped in. An explosion has hit near Afghanistan's defense facility in the capital, Kabul. The blast that rocked the area around the National Directorate of Security injured two civilians and a security official. It followed a string of deadly bomb attacks close to Kabul's diplomatic district. Afghanistan's defense minister said the coordinated strikes were aimed at him. The interior ministry said those attacks had been repelled and all the attackers had been killed. The Taliban claimed responsibility and vowed to carry out more assaults against top government officials. Well, China reports its highest daily number of coronavirus infections in 6 months, mainly blamed on the Delta variant of the virus. The spike in cases comes as health authorities are mass testing entire cities and locking down millions of residents. The city of Wuhan, where the virus first emerged in 2019, has reported its first local infections in over a year. The city plans to launch testing of 11 million residents elsewhere in Nanjing. Authorities have tested the city's 9.2 million residents three times after shutting down gyms and cinemas and closing off residential compounds. India reports more than 42,600 new coronavirus infections, pushing the total caseload to nearly 32 million. The figure is nearly 40% higher than the previous day. Health authorities say 560 people also succumbed to the disease in the past 24 hours, bringing the total number of fatalities to over 425,000. A number of states, including Mizoram, Karnataka, Puducherry, and Kerala, are among those hit hard by the pandemic. This is while some states are expected to lift the restrictions put in place to curb the outbreak. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. You should not be a slave to others because God has made you free. You should choose on your own. You are free to choose your fate. This is one of the obvious points in Islam. Therefore, the people's authority and democracy is reliant on these religious teachings. The Quran, Hadith, Nahjul Balagha, and the Holy Prophets and the Commander of the Faithful's behavior reflect these teachings in the Siffin Sermon. Sermon number 216. The Commander of the Faithful says, therefore, do not abstain from saying a truth or pointing out a matter of justice. It basically says, do not avoid giving me counsel and express your opinion about my ways and methods. This is how it is. So the people's responsibility and rights are based on Islam. This was the first perspective. Government's need for popular support. The second perspective of the discussion about the Republican aspect of the Islamic Republic is about support and the need for popular support. This is also an obvious point. If governments, not just religious governments, rather all governments, are deprived of popular support, and if the people do not advocate them, they will have to live a life of wielding swords and cracking whips. In other words, it will not be possible to sustain the government. Of course, an Islamic and Quranic government is not after oppressing the people, wielding its sword and whipping the people. Therefore, it cannot live without the people's support. It was neither possible to create the Islamic Republic without popular support, nor was it possible after its formation to sustain the government without such support. Thankfully, the system has continued to exist, and it will continue to exist from now on too.
More than 15 million American renters are at risk of eviction without backup as abandoned residential evictions expired on Saturday at midnight. Early Sunday, some Democratic lawmakers rallied outside the Capitol to call for the ban's reinstatement. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered the moratorium to fight the spread of the COVID-19 and prevent homelessness during the pandemic. It came into effect in September 2020 and has been extended multiple times. The U.S. Congress had approved around $47 billion in rental relief to states during the pandemic, but the money has been slow to make it into the hands of those in need. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said only $3 billion out of the total allocated fund has been distributed to renters. Pelosi and other top Democrats have urged the administration of Joe Biden to extend the moratorium through October the 18th. The U.S. President Joe Biden is under fire by his own party members. The Democrats criticized Biden's inaction as the deadline neared, some furious that he called on Congress to provide a last-minute solution to protect renters. Biden had asked Congress to extend the deadline on Thursday amid the surging Delta variant, but Congress failed to act after Republican House members blocked a Democratic-led bid. The House has already left for a six-week summer recess, and it remains unclear whether the administration could extend the moratorium using executive powers.
It's a partisan issue. There's absolutely no difficulty with the United States providing the money to their own citizens to enable them to pay their rental commitments. And it's something I argued back in March of 2020, where it's absolutely necessary, because if you're going to fight the virus, you have to enable people to stay at home. If they stay at home, they can't earn an income, so they must be given a cash flow to cover their outgoings, so you don't get people being made homeless courtesy of fighting a pandemic.
Pressure is mounting on U.S. lawmakers to extend a moratorium that barred landlords from evicting certain tenants who could not pay rent during the pandemic. This put millions of Americans at risk of being homeless amid the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, top U.S. infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci has warned that the coronavirus situation in the United States is set to get worse as the country grapples with a surge in the Delta variant of the COVID-19. The U.S. is currently the worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Homeless Americans could face other challenges as well. For instance, Los Angeles has approved a new law that makes it illegal for unhoused people to be in almost all places across the city. If you become homeless in LA, that's the fair fate that awaits you. That's why the latest city count shows LA has over 66,000 homeless people.
And it shows the extent to which the American political system uses its own people as a bargaining chip or a shuttlecock in this battle between the two ruling parties. So it's utterly unnecessary and will be very damaging. And again, it's a sign of just how divided America is these days that this is being allowed to happen.
The expiration of the U.S. eviction ban could send millions of people out on the streets. Then they're faced with the threat of the coronavirus and hunger. Currently, around 40 million low-income Americans rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program to stay out of hunger. It seems the U.S. politicians are more interested in spending money on wars and U.S. military bases and adventures around the world instead of their own people. An Israeli petroleum products tanker managed by Israeli-owned Zodiac Maritime came under attack off the coast of Oman on Thursday. The London-based company later claimed that two crewmen, a Briton and a Romanian, had been killed in the assault. The US, Israel and their allies rushed to point the finger at Iran for the attack, while the official investigation has only begun and is not completed yet. Meanwhile, a source close to the resistance axis said the attack on the Mercer Street tanker was a retaliation for Israeli aggression in Syria, particularly the latest attack on Davao Airport that left two resistant forces dead. In recent months, several other Israeli ships have been targeted in various maritime routes across the world. Earlier in the month, a fire broke out on an Israeli-owned cargo ship after it was struck by an unidentified weapon in the northeastern Indian Ocean. Back in February, an Israeli-owned ship was hit by an explosion in the Sea of Oman. In April, another Israeli ship came under attack off the coast of the UAE.
Resistance access won't permit Israelis to commit any crimes without retaliation, whether from the Yemen or Lebanon or Syria or Palestine or Tehran or any place of the resistance axis. So I guess they have to expect that the resistance forces can reach them anywhere. So they are playing a losing game with the resistance axis, whether when they attack at Syrian borders or the Iraq-Syrian borders or at Tehran when they commit assassinations or do any aggressions against this power. Now the balance of power is for the sake or for the interest of the access of resistance.
The retaliatory attack has exposed the vulnerability of Israeli entities in the region and sent a strong message to Israel that the resistance front will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity. Western countries have condemned the latest attack on the Israeli-owned ship off the Oman coast, while they have always shut their eyes to Israel's crimes. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011, and millions more are suffering due to the crippling sanctions and economic war imposed on Syria by the US government. That's while Washington's ally, the occupying regime of Israel, has attacked Syria on a continual basis. Also, the Syrian government blames the Israeli regime and its Western regional allies for aiding Takfiri terrorist groups wreaking havoc in the country. The latest attacks on Israeli ships come against the backdrop of Tel Aviv's various assaults on cargo ships across the Persian Gulf region and elsewhere. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. Israel is also responsible for several instances of acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program over the past decade, including attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of its scientists.
A root cause of the tension, the deplorable level of tension in the Middle East that the world has been witness to for many decades now, is the fact that Israel acts with impunity. Israel is given a blank check, so to speak, year on year from Washington and London to do as it pleases in the Middle East. If America and Britain truly respected international law, if they truly respected the Charter of the United Nations, and if they truly respected the concept of state sovereignty, then they would put an end to Israel's flagrant violations of international law.
The international community's silence in the face of Tel Aviv's crimes is a result of the US shielding of the illegitimate regime of Israel. Tel Aviv has for long been able to get away with its crimes without any prosecution. However, the latest move by the resistance axis shows that Tel Aviv's hit-and-run tactic is no longer useful. Now, it must face the music and taste its own medicine.
On Thursday, Israel attained observer status at the African Union after nearly 20 years of lobbying. Making the move official, Israeli ambassador to Ethiopia, Burundi, and Chad presented his credentials to Moussa Faki Mohammed, the chairman of the African Union Commission, at the bloc's headquarters in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
But for African countries, Palestine is now no longer a priority. Unfortunately, for some Arab countries that have turned their back to Palestine, this is the same.
The move was met with harsh criticism from Palestinian resistance groups and several African nations. In a letter to the chairperson of the African Union, head of Hamas political wing Ismail Haniyeh said the decision contradicts the principles of the organization. He added that the move deals a heavy blow to the Palestinian people and their legitimate rights. Haniyeh called on Faki to reverse the decision, indicating that it does not reflect the truth of the stance of the Union toward the Palestinian cause. South Africa also fiercely objected to the move by the Union. It said the AU Commission made the decision unilaterally without consulting its members.
Now, none of the member states were officially consulted, except those that are probably pro-Israeli. The pro-Israeli ones are well known. It's Kenya, it's Tanzania, it's Rwanda, Togo, Cameroon. These are the countries that are backing this move.
The South African Foreign Ministry has called the AU's move, quote, incomprehensible and inexplicable. The South African government said the African Union's decision is even more shocking in a year in which oppressed people of Palestine were hounded by destructive bombardments and continued illegal settlements of the land. It was referring to Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip in May that killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children. The war broke out after the regime's decision to evict several Palestinian families from their homes in the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah.
Now, South Africa has been preceded by Algeria, and in Algeria a week ago was up in arms at this decision without having been consulted, and said it was contrary to the charter of the Africa Union, that the charter does not allow apartheid states, a state that practices racism as its official policy, to be part of as an observer, and that commits atrocities against an occupied population. And today, Namibia has joined South Africa.
Israel previously held observer status in the predecessor organization of African Unity until 2002, when the organization was disbanded and replaced by the AU. Pro-Palestine language is typically featured in statements delivered at the AU's annual summits. Palestine already has observer status at the African Union. Besides, the United States, Israel's closest ally, also operates in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism there. However, local sources say civilians have been the main victims of the attacks conducted by U.S. forces.
In fact, even in southern, on the southern border of Syria, in the Quneitra region, Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra, who are terrorist organization fighting against the Syrian government, have been assisted, aided both militarily, financially, logistically by Israel. So, I mean, this is, of course, just diplomatic talk.
That underlines the risk for Africa to have a possible Israeli military presence, as the Israeli regime is already facing a probe over war crimes committed in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank.
Ties between the United States and Russia are far worse than strained. The two have been on a confrontational path for a very long time. Tensions have been deteriorating over the past years after a series of tit-for-tat actions that have left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such tit-for-tat actions, like consulate closures or expulsions of diplomats, have made it difficult to even conduct basic bilateral diplomacy. The lack of proper diplomatic contacts between the two rivals has increased the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a potential disaster. Recently, Russia's top diplomat warned that tensions between Washington and Moscow were getting close to a dangerous confrontation. The two sides say they want to prevent any such scenario. This week, diplomats from the U.S. and Russia sat down for talks on strategic stability. The talks in Geneva were arranged in June when U.S. President Joe Biden met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two major nuclear-armed states.
I think that what's happened in the last 20 years under Putin's basic leadership, I think for the last 20 years, has been a resurgence of Russian power, of Russian technology, of the place of Russia in the world. And as a major country, the United States doesn't like that.
Can the ongoing diplomatic effort help reduce tensions and pave the way for cooperation? The meeting on Wednesday was the first in a series of planned talks aimed at enhancing communication and reduce the possibility of missteps. The delegations were headed by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov. The U.S. side called the discussions professional and substantive. The Russians said they were satisfied with the conclusions and that America showed readiness for constructive dialogue. But despite the positive signs, controversial comments by the U.S. president drew condemnation from Moscow. In an address to national intelligence officers, Joe Biden accused Russia of trying to interfere in the 2022 U.S. midterm elections. He warned that an escalation in cyber attacks could lead to war. Biden also said Russia has nuclear weapons and oil wells, and nothing else to earn money from. The U.S. president claimed this economic weakness makes Russia even more unpredictable and dangerous. The Russians were quick to respond. The Kremlin said Biden's statements showed America's erroneous understanding of modern Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow regrets that America is more of an adversary than a partner, despite the Russian government showing political will to normalize ties. Observers believe the latest exchanges further reveal the depth of distrust and deep differences between Washington and Moscow.
Russians have begun to reassert their normal geographic dominance in the area. And in particular, this was true with Ukraine. And, you know, so can you imagine the situation if the Russians had on the Canadian border, you know, an army? We would freak out. Well, the Russians feel the same way about NATO being in the middle of Europe now. And they felt very, very betrayed by the fact that NATO expanded, because they felt they had a deal in the 1980s with Gorbachev that wouldn't happen. And so they're upset about that and have been very clear about that.
Problems that have soured bilateral relations are many, and both sides seem unwilling to back down when it comes to strategic issues. The upcoming talks will probably show whether the two sides are serious enough to resolve their problems.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
There are a couple of scholars who came with the new ideas, who came with the better principles. And when they came up with those principles and better ideas, how to extract something out of the statement that we have, or what are the principles? Mirza Nain is one of those scholars.
It must be indicated that amongst the publications and works of the late Ayatollah Mirza Manat Hussein Gharavi Naini, his book Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah is very significant.
Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All-Beneficent, the All-Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio. This is the teacher, I'm Ata, the host of this program. I have two guest speakers for my today's discussion in the program. The teacher, Dr. Mohammad Reza Fakhruhani, and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Dr. Mohammad Reza Fakhruhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, Dr. Mohammad Reza Fakhruhani, let's start with you, brother. In our previous discussion, we talked about Mirza Naini's ideas and his researches regarding Usul al-Fiqh and Fiqh, and we said that the important point and the significant point which made him different from the other scholars of his time was the component of his political thought, which were deeply rooted in his, we can say, Islamic and religious thought. In one of the speeches and the textbooks, he defines the political participation as the pillar of the Islamic government. Also, he says that the ideal Islamic government is based on consultation, and freedom and equality was one of the slogans of the constitutional revolution in Iran. And he defended all of these principles. And what is important is that he was anti-despotic, anti-colonialism and imperialism of his time. I think he had quite enough characteristics and features of becoming a leader of a freedom movement, what we call in the 21st century for today's discussion. Talk a little bit about this aspect of the life of Mirza Naini for us, his political thoughts.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa li nasta'in. In this regard, it must be indicated that one of the important, I should like to say, instructive aspects of Shi'i seminaries, I mean, no matter where they may be, whether in India, in Iran, in Iraq, or elsewhere, or nowadays, for example, in Lebanon, okay, One of the educative aspects is that they tried to redefine the political thought within the framework of Shi'i religiosity and Shi'i religious standards.
That's right.
In order to do this, first of all, they tried to take lessons from the early Islamic history. Okay, mainly from the life of and the seerah, the words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, as well as around a 5-year government or administration of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Personally, I believe the life and times of all the infallible imams are replete with many points and many lessons from which political thought can be reframed or can be deduced.
That's right.
Okay. In this regard, it must be indicated, first of all, in the today political or geopolitical thought, there's the concept of transnationality, mm-hmm. and transnationality has got many definitions. I believe that the late Amir Zain Naini wasn't a man of thinking about Islamic transnationality. No, he was a man of thinking about Islamic transreligiosity. Okay? Mm-hmm. When he defines, in his book, Tanbih al-Ummah, when he comes to discuss characteristics of the political framework or political scenario of such a country like Iran, he never makes any distinction between, for example, Sunnis and Shiis, in contrast to, for example, Christians or Zoroastrians, Jews, and some other people. When it comes to discuss political framework of a new and at that time emerging government in Iran, he talks about in Persia at that time.
That's right.
When he comes to talk about this, he draws a very broad map in this regard, and within this map, all ethnic groups, all, for example,
followers
or minorities, all of them are included.
Okay.
He wouldn't say, he never said that. Okay, for example, this right is specifically applied to or used for, Shiis in contrast to Sunnis, or Christians in contrast to Zoroastrians, and so on. Okay, from this we understand that what I should like to refer to as Shi'i Islamic transreligiosity, it must make something it must be quite implicit not explicitly stated, but it can be deduced from the gist of the sociopolitical thought of the late Emir Zain Naini.
That's right.
However, there was one point. The remainder knew one point. The point was that at that time the Qajar dynasty over there, in Persia, they were really very despotic, and they never recognized any right for people, even for the courtiers, to express themselves. Okay, whatever might be the whim of a king or monarch over there, it was the rule. In fact, the king referred himself as the rule in the whole nation.
That's right.
The late Naini came forward and drafted his book, Tanbih al-Umma, in order to say that it wasn't the right way of managing the affairs of a nation. But at the same time, we find that when he drafted his book, he wrote his book in Persian, and it was first published in Baghdad, followed by subsequent reprint editions elsewhere, and even in Arabic translation. We find that in his book, he defended the right of the nation in order to have an assembly or a parliament, in order to discuss important issues. Mm-hmm. But in order for the laws, phrased over there, not to be against or in contrast to Islamic religious ideas, teachings, and instructions, it was necessary for at least 5 great mujtahids to be present over there. However, it was, it's a reality that I should like to say that not after the, after the emergence of the constitutional movement, but somewhat, before the coming up of the constitutional movement, some agents of Western powers made themselves or crept into the the movement, and little by little they made a digression.
That's okay? Right, digression.
It wasn't, I mean...
The constitutional revolution was diverted and digressed.
It was diverted on purpose, right. Okay?
Yes.
Mirza Naini couldn't anticipate this. Okay? Mm-hmm. As a scholar, well, I mean, he developed his book, okay? Like any scholar, for example, even in the social sciences. No, take, for example, mathematics, take geometry.
I know
okay?
what you mean, okay.
And a scholar writes his book, but it isn't his responsibility if his ideas, ideals, and teachings might be misapplied.
That's why maybe he regretted writing this book.
Yes.
But we'll get to this book more. Nice introduction, a nice background you gave us about the political thoughts of Mirza Naini. But Said Mohsen Naghvi, for an alim, and a scholar, a religious scholar, Marjai Taghli, the religious authority on that time, of this high caliber of understanding, we can say, also knowing about the political thoughts of his time, and also being concerned with the socio-political atmosphere of his time, seems a little bit to be rare on that time. But Mirza Naini was a different case, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Since we live in an secular atmosphere
now
environment, and our studies are all based on the secular thoughts, you know, whatever we learn, because you know we learn to earn money, we study in order to have a good job.
That's right.
We do not study for the sake of Allah Subhanahu wa Taala.
Yes.
We don't study for our own selves. To become a better human being or to become a perfect person. No. Our aim to study is to, you know, either become a doctor, because doctors have a you know, high, we can say, like
salary, that's right.
Or maybe the economist, or maybe a professor, or I don't know. There are different fields. We study for this world. That's why we cannot think of a religious person being involved in the politics.
That's right.
Whereas the original Islamic studies, we mentioned this, that everything is within Islam, the politics, economics, I don't know, the social affairs, the ethics, everything is within Islam. Quran is talking about everything. The Prophet has talked about everything. Islam has everything within it.
That's all right.
It's not separate from Islam. So if a scholar is being active in a political, we can say, like field or economical field, it's not something far from, you know, the imaginations.
That's right.
Why? Because I can just give you a couple of examples. You know, the father of medicine, the father of, I don't know, differences like geometry.
Yes.
We see they all were the Muslim scholars.
Mm-hmm.
These were the scholars. We can see the buildings.
The golden age of Islam, that's right.
Yeah. The buildings that were built in Isfahan, we're talking about Isfahan very much, like he's from Isfahan. They were made by the Muslim scholars.
Yes, sir,
like Sheikh Baha'i was there. The other scholars were there at the time of Qajar even. So the scholars itself, like obviously because we have everything within Islam, that's why they were active as well.
Right.
About the political activities of Mirza Naini, I just want to mention one part which is missed in this discussion, is that when the First World War in 1914, it was started, England took almost most of the parts of the Iraqi land.
Okay.
And when this happened during that World War One, the Shia ulama, all of them, they raised against it, and they gave the fatwa of jihad to the people of Iraq. And therefore, the people of Iraq, because they were the followers, especially, you know, the southern part of it, which is like, we can say like Kufa, Najaf, Karbala, and all those, these were the Shia parts. They fought against it, but obviously they couldn't obviously fight against the British government of that time. So they were deceived by the British government, and the British government took over the rulership of the whole Iraq. And after that, Mirza Naini was also involved in those ulamas.
That's right.
Who gave fatwa against it, who were very much active against these people.
That's all right.
After they got the control of Iraq, the British government, they announced like the people should vote for one of the Britishers to become the president or the in charge of the whole Iraqi, we can say, state. Over there, again, we see that Sheikh Naini, Mirza Naini, and other ulamas, they stood against this decision.
That's
and
right.
They gave a fatwa. They said a kafir, a disbeliever, cannot become a ruler of
Muslim land. That's right.
And when this happened, the England was deceived by this, you know, rulings that were issued by the Shia scholars, especially It was the time of, we can say, like Mirza Naini and Ayatollah Sayyid Abul Hassan Isfahani.
That's right.
Both of them. And after this fatwa, England brought Sheikh Faisal as a ruler of Iraqi people.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they asked him to have an election. Even that time, they stood against because he was the representative of the disbelievers. So the Najaf and Karbala did not participate in the elections. Mm. So when these all things happened, the British government pressurized the, you know, Sheikh Faisal, and they expelled the Sheikh Naini and Mirza Naini and Ayatollah Abul Hassan Isfahani, both of them, to Iran.
That's right.
So when they came to Iran, they have a big, you know, welcoming.
That's right.
Over here, a warm welcoming.
Okay.
But on the other hand, the Shia ulama, they pressurized Sheikh Faisal. And in 13, I think the date is 1342 Hijri, it was the time when Sheikh Faisal apologized from these two big scholars.
Yes.
And they asked them to come back to Najaf. Mm. And that was the time when they came back to Najaf. So in their political life, we can see like they were very much active. Why? Because, you know, when you study Islam, in Islam, the rulership is for God, and that is the main theme. Like, we are monotheists, we believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And whoever he appoints as an authority, that person becomes the authority.
That's
cannot accept. And that's why, you know, our dear guest has referred to the, he referred to the book which he wrote. And that also shows purely like what is the basic, we can say, rulings and the ideas of a ruler or the government in Islam. Basically.
Very good. And and that book, we are talking about Tanbihul Ummah wa Tanzihul Millah. We can say, informing the nation and purifying the religion, the most outstanding book of Mirza Naini, has attracted the thoughts of not only the researchers of his time, but the following generations of how a Muslim alim or a scholar, a religious authority, an ayatollah, can write a book about Islam, which is applicable also in the socio-political scene of his era and his time. And this is very important. Inshallah, we will dedicate our next session of the program to this book, specifically, Tanbihul Ummah wa Tanzihul Millah, compiled by Mirza Naini. But thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, for your presence in this program, and Dr. Mamaza Fakhruhani. Thank you very much, brother.
Thank you. You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, on Call of Islam Radio. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Over 2 dozen news outlets, including Press TV, had their .com domains seized and were completely taken offline. So why these websites? What do the vast majority of these news outlets have in common? Why were they targeted by the United States? And what does that say about a country that claims to champion so-called democracy and freedom of the press? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On June 23rd, 2021, the United States government seized the websites of several news broadcasters and media outlets belonging to Iran and its allies in one fell swoop. The websites targeted included Palestine Today, as well as Iran's Al Alam, which is an Arabic language broadcaster. They included Iraq's Al Furat and Yemen's Al Masira, just to name a few of the 33 outlets seized by the U.S. Among them was also this network, Press TV, where I myself have been proud to host my television program, The Communique, since late 2020. Anyone attempting to access PressTV.com is now met with a sign that reads, "This website has been seized," bearing the daunting seal of the U.S. Department of Justice and Department of Commerce. It's important to understand the U.S. government didn't just block these news sites inside the United States or in its own borders. It blocked them worldwide for everyone, rendering them inaccessible after seizing their .com domains. And of course, when we say seized,